system is accurate. Why would rishis that knew all of these things in detail
would make up stories in the rest of their publication that just, oh, somebody did this and Lord Nrsingadeva appeared half man, half lion, and it's silly. Who would believe such stories? You follow? Prabhupada wanted for the world of doubting personalities to appreciate the richness of the Vedic wisdom. He also wanted many people to come to Sridhar Mayapur while seeing the planetarium to see Lord Chaitanya and get the mercy of Lord Chaitanya, and this way spiritually uplift the world by getting Lord Chaitanya's mercy. They may not come to Mayapur to get Lord Chaitanya's mercy, but they may come to Mayapur to see this fantastic planetarium. You follow? That was Prabhupada's wish. So he gave that to his disciples to do. You know, 39 years ago. It's not done yet. But even to make the plan of what Prabhupada described with his words and with his hands, well, we got the concept. To get it down, this chandelier mechanism is going to move as the planets move. Some moving faster, some moving slower. Imagine. And in the dome, as you go up the dome, there's what's the right word? Balconies or tiers that are, you can look horizontally out and see, now you're at this planetary level, now you're at that planetary level. And on the outside are going to be exhibits. You press a button and it tells you the story of what you see out there. Like, what's life on this region? What's life on that region? Up to the topmost spheres of this universe, and then some description of what's beyond the universe. Because the Vedas tell us what's beyond the universe. Pretty neat, huh? And it's going to cost a couple of dollars. But Prabhupada wanted it, and somehow it has to happen. So, in this coming year, there will be, you know, more sharing about. If I had the video to show you, I would show you. It's dazzling. You have to hold on to your socks when you watch this thing, because it's amazing what they're attempting to do. They have a plan to do, and they've made a cost estimate also. That's just in the planetarium, and then finishing the temple. It's awesome. It'll be definitely a world attraction. Not just India attraction, a world attraction. And people will come and they'll get Lord Chaitanya's mercy. And the other part, which I already mentioned, is they'll begin to have some appreciation of this. The ancient wisdom has all this understanding in minute, empirical detail. Let's take a look at all the rest of what that same wisdom has to say about reality, you know, or truth with a capital T, or reality with a capital R, or God with a capital G. It'll be amazing. The impact will be amazing. So that's a little sharing. And what I'd like to do is then carry on from there. Like to describe a little bit of the first part of Canto 6, because the first part of Canto 6 follows Canto 5, and Canto 5 is the description of the material universe and the structure of it, and what the names of the planets and the inhabitants of the planets. And it starts with this middle planetary region called Bhuloka, just like you know from Gayatri Mantra, Bhuloka, Bhuvarloka, and Swargaloka. Those are three planetary systems. In the upper portion, I'll wait till everybody gets settled here because it's distracting. Our children are restless. Take off. See you guys. How you go? Come on in. There's more coming. Okay, so we're going to do some numbers. In scriptures of the world, there's a conception of heaven and of the bad place, the hellish region, and where we are, the middle region. So upper, middle, and lower planetary systems. Vedic literature has a similar concept. However, above the heavenly regions, the Vedas say there's total 14 planetary systems, 7 upper, 7 lower. So it begins the description of this place, and then above this place, Bhuvarloka and Swargaloka, but you should know. Above Swargaloka, there's 4 other planetary systems. Above heaven, in this universe, there's 4 other planetary systems. Maharloka, Janaloka, Tapaloka, and Lord Brahma's abode, Satyaloka. And it describes them in detail. And then after that description, it goes to the lower 7. And the lower 7 are not nice places. Not, you know, besides what some scriptures say of, you know, it's hot, it's burning and hot and dark and, you know, nasty. There's different hells, different planetary systems according to different sinful behaviors, and there's consequences for those sinful behaviors, and it's awful. And that's how the fifth canto ends. When the sixth canto begins, Maharishi Parikshit, he was the emperor of the world, the grandson of the Pandavas. So he's very elevated, and an elevated person is naturally compassionate. So though he's been cursed to die in 7 days, and by the time they get to the fifth canto, out of 12 cantos, it's at least day 3, he has 4 more days left, something like that. And he's not thinking about he's going to die in 4 days. He's thinking about all those people that are going to have to experience suffering in those hellish planets. He's compassionate. As an elevated soul is compassionate. So he asks Shukadeva Goswami, sixth canto begins, but he's asking Shukadeva Goswami, what can be done to help those who are destined for such hellish destinations to not have to suffer in that hellish situation? Compassionate question. And please note that this question is the classic, one of the classic questions of any religion. People of this world have a tendency to act in sinful ways. What's the antidote or the measure to relieve one of suffering for sinful reactions? And this religion has, and that religion has, and the other religion has their idea, and that's one of the things that differentiates them between one religion and another, isn't it? What's to be done to relieve people of the reactions of their sins? So the answer that Shukadeva Goswami gives it's very interesting, and at the same time it's curious how he answers. And our acharyas explain, because he's already spoken five cantos, and the answer to the question that Shukadeva, the Maharishi Parikshit, is asking has been embedded in things already presented. So he gives him like a surprise quiz. You know what that is in school, right? Teacher comes in and says, guess what? Surprise quiz. I didn't tell you. Okay, close your book. Here's your exam. But Maharishi Parikshit didn't even get that signal from Shukadeva Goswami. Shukadeva Goswami gave him a sounds good, but it wasn't exactly the right answer to see how well his student was listening. You with me? I was making an application because I turned 65. I was making an application for Medicaid. And I found out this later. But there's certain things that they do when they do interviews to see if you're a liar. They give you misinformation and they ask you, you know, is this correct? If you're a liar, you say, yeah, it's correct. And they know that it's not because you just made it up. You follow? And then they know this isn't an honest person. I can't trust their word. And you don't get the reciprocation from the government they're trained to see who's honest and who's dishonest. That's one of the methods. So something like that, Shukadeva Goswami gave an answer that wasn't the complete answer, which he's already given in the previous five cantos. So the answer that he gave was very nice question, Maharishi Parikshit. For persons who may engage in sinful activity, the Vedas provide a process of prayaschitta or atonement. Prayaschitta or atonement. Anybody not know what that is? Prayaschitta or atonement. So when there's a Vedic yajna, after the yajna, there's a procedure that if there's some mistake that has been made in the yajna, it neutralizes the reaction for that mistake. Or Prabhupada would often speak about this in Catholic religion. They have a procedure called confession. They go to the priest. I didn't grow up in a Catholic family, but I had a friend that did, and he would, on Friday afternoon or whatever it was, Saturday morning, we were together, I remember, he went to go into the priest and say, I did these bad things. And then there was confession. The priest is there. He sits in a special box or place or room, so it's private. You confess to the priest you did something, and then he recommends you do the following process of atonement. So owning up to your mistakes is one part of it. And then so many prayers, you have a Hail Mary prayer, so many Hail Mary prayers, it puts something in the hundi box. That process of atonement, Prabhupada would say, he would explain to us, it's inadequate because after doing the atonement, then one goes out and does the same thing again and comes back and, you know, says, gee, I'm sorry, and go out and do the same thing again. It doesn't take away the tendency to do the same thing. Although it may neutralize, at least valid systems of prayaschitta may neutralize the reaction. It doesn't take away the tendency. It's there, it's Vedic. So the answer is not wrong, but it's incomplete. So when Maharishi Parikshit hears this answer from Shukadeva Goswami, and he knows it's not complete, now what do you do if you're the student and you hear your teacher say something that's not complete? Challenging, isn't it? Well, what's the etiquette? Here's how Maharishi Parikshit responded. He said, this sounds very nice, but I have a doubt. Can you please explain to me? How is it that this process of atonement may neutralize the sin, but it doesn't take away the tendency for sin. And then the elaboration of that is, he doesn't say this explicitly, but as the king, from first-hand experience, he administered his kingdom according to the laws of Manu. And when people did some wrong activity, they were punished according to the laws of Manu. And then they were released after the punishment, and guess what? They went out and did the same thing again. So it may neutralize the reaction, but it doesn't take away the tendency. So what I just described is one portion of the Vedas. Please appreciate this. The Srimad Bhagavatam is not teaching this ism versus that ism versus another ism. It's teaching principles. It's a science. So karma kanda is perform rituals for elevation, and if there's some mistake, there's prayaschitta. Karma kanda stays on the material platform. It doesn't take away tendency. Is to elevate progressively through the modes of nature towards the quality of goodness, towards the heavenly region. Yes? And there's beyond the heavenly region, there's beyond this universe too, the kingdom of God. So, Shukadeva Goswami says, you get an A. You passed your surprise quiz exam. Because, what you say is true. It doesn't take away tendency, and therefore development of knowledge is very important. Because when there's knowledge, then you can check tendency. Now, that's deficient too. Because when there's knowledge, just like us, we may know that something, if I do such and such, it will be very beneficial for me. And we consider in light of scripture and hear from authorities and we decide, I'm going to do this. And some time passes and we're not consistent in doing this. Or the converse, something is not so good. If I could get rid of this something that's not so good, that would be wholesome and beneficial. And we think about it from different angles and study from scripture and we reach the conclusion. The knowledge is very clear. This should be given up. And we find ourselves doing that something that we should be given up. So knowledge alone is not sufficient. That's another level of the Vedas called Jnana Kanda. You with me? Karma Kanda, Jnana Kanda. And I'd like to read two verses. The Jnana Kanda message. So, Prabhupada calls this the regulative principles of knowledge. He used that term, regulative principles, in other respects, the regulative principles of freedom, the four principles that he wanted his followers in the Hare Krishna movement to perform. Here he calls this, you can look it up later, to Canto 6, Chapter 1, Text 13 and 14. It starts with a life of tapasya. Tapasya, brahmacharjena, samena, dhamena cha, tyagena, satya, shochabhyam, yamena, niyamena va. So these are describing principles like, you know, principles that a student should follow, someone that wants knowledge. So a student doesn't have to be, you know, like the children that are assembled in the room. It's anyone that wants knowledge. Not age-related, it's principle. There must be sense control, mind control, and cleanliness, and truthfulness, and basically brahminical quality. Because from brahminical quality, from the quality of goodness, knowledge is accessible. You can grasp things that are subtle when your consciousness is refined in the quality of goodness. And those that are practitioners of jnana kanda, pursuing brahma jnana, knowledge of the realm of the absolute, other than, you know, how to get things done in this plane and enjoy karmakanda, the realm of transcendence. But there's another stage that's beyond that. Within the Vedas, there's these three divisions. And the third division is the division then that becomes the basis of the sixth canto and summarizes in one sense the whole message of Srimad Bhagavatam. That's the verse I wanted to especially focus on. So again, if you have Srimad Bhagavatam or one of your little devices like these gentlemen have, a tablet or Access Veda base, if you don't have the Bhagavatam in your home, you can look it up later. 6.1.15. Kechit kevalaya bhaktya vasudeva parayana agham dunvanti karchneya niharam iva bhaskaram. That's the verse. So I'll go through it slowly. This is our discussion for the evening, so listen carefully. Kechit kevalaya bhaktya. Kechit means some people. So it's like a pyramid. There's the unregulated many people. Some people are regulated by the Vedas and they're interested in material elevation. Some are interested in spiritual understanding and some are interested in developing love of God. So kechit, some amongst the pyramid of many. Kevalaya bhaktya. Kevala is a very strong word. Kevala is the same word that's used by followers of impersonalism. Kevala Advaita, absolute monism. That's how the teachings of Shankaracharya are characterized. Absolute monism. So this is not absolute monism, it's absolute bhakti. Kevalaya bhaktya. Nothing, squeaky clean, nothing but devotion to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Then Vasudeva Parayana. And Vasudeva Parayana is another strong statement. And if I may, a little of my kind of unsophisticated armchair appreciation of the beauty of the Bhagavatam. In the Bhagavatam, there are certain phrases that, like a musical composition, certain sequence of notes that a composer may put, like in a symphony. Because when I was in school, I was part of an orchestra, and I learned just not by studying in a classroom, just by appreciating how compositions would work. With a whole set of instruments, the composer, and then led by the orchestra person, let's say the series of notes is do 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 do, then the oboes go do 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 do, and the piccolos go do 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 do, and the oboes or the bass go boom 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 boom, and then several of them, and they go over somewhere and do some other things, and they come back do 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 do. And then the violins. So there's a certain theme in an orchestration that carries a mood, and with the mood, perhaps also a message that goes along with the orchestration. Something like that. Within the Bhagavatam, similarly, there are certain phrases that repeat themselves. And it's purposeful. The repetition is purposeful. It's to carry a message. And here, the phrase is Vasudeva Parayana. And that phrase, Vasudeva Parayana, appears about four times more in really key, tension-filled positions within the Bhagavatam, Sixth Canto, just within the Sixth Canto. Where Vasudeva Parayana means, the word for word is Parayana, completely attached only to such service without dependence on other things. Completely attached to Vasudeva Parayana. An example of where this appears again, the do-do-do-do-do phrase, is later in this canto, where there's a king named Chitraketu, and Chitraketu is a highly advanced personality, but he has an attachment. It's, you know, it can happen. Highly elevated people can have an attachment. And his attachment was very specific. He wanted to have a son because he's the king, and it's the duty of the son to produce a successor to the throne, so he wanted a son, and it wasn't happening. So it's a long narration, but he married many, many queens, one after another, with the hope that a son would come, and it didn't happen. So he was despondent. The number of queens he had was astronomical, big number. So Angira Muni visited his palace, and he saw the king look despondent. So he asked him, is there some difficulty in your kingdom? Are your subjects unruly, or is your treasury not replete, or is your army not strong, or is the grain not being produced due to insufficient rain, or is there some difficulty in your kingdom? It seems to me everything is very nice. And King Chitraketu said, I know that you know, but you're just asking anyway. And here's my distress. I want a son. I don't have a son. And you're a great sage. Please help me. There must be something you can do, some mystical something, so I can have a son. Please, please. Angira could understand, even before he spoke, this man is too attached. He can't hear anything. So he made an arrangement by a yagya whereby his elder queen could bear a son. Kayadu, I think, was her name. So, is that right? No. Oh, that's another one. Huh? Hiranyakashipu's wife. Kritajyuti? Kritajyuti. Huh? She's confirming. Kritajyuti. So, from the... similar to how Dasarath was able to produce a son, a potion was provided through that yagya, given to Kritajyuti. She took the potion, she was able to conceive a son. So now the king is happy. Angira said, I can tell you in advance, before you say yes to this, your son will be both a source of jubilation and suffering. And the king thought, well, maybe the son won't be so obedient and he'll talk back or something, but better to have a son than no son. So he agreed. So he said, I'll give your son a name even before he's conceived. His name will be Harshashoka. It means happiness, distress. Harshashoka. Happiness, distress. So that's how the king named his son when the son was born. And now everybody's happy, because now not only there's piety in the land and everything is bountiful, but now the king has his son. And everyone was happy except the queens that didn't have a son. And there was a lot of them. If I remember, it was... anyway, it's either 10,000 or 10,000,000. 9,999 co-wives were unhappy, because the king was just spending all his time with Kritajyuti and his new son and just ignoring them. So they became envious. And for some, their envy was over the top. And they became so contaminated by envy, they decided to kill the child. So they poisoned the boy in his sleep. So the whole scene, the queen comes, Krittaduti, to go see her son early in the morning, and when she sees the son lying there, his eyes closed, holds his hand is cold, she screams, "Ah, my son is dead." And the king hears her scream, and he comes running and falls at the crib of the little child and crying and crying and crying, and Harsha Shoka. Just at that time, by their uncanny ability to know when to appear at the right time, Angira Muni and Narada Muni come right at that moment. And now the king is ready to hear transcendental knowledge. So they impart transcendental knowledge. And it's long, very valuable understanding of how to understand the real identity of the living being, not in terms of the body and bodily relation, but in terms of the eternal soul. And hearing all this, the king is just amazed. And he says, you know, "Who are you? What you're speaking is so eloquent and brilliant and relieving my anxiety." Angira said, "You're so delirious, you don't even recognize I'm Angira Muni, I'm the one who made the arrangement for you to have your son. And here's my friend Narada. So please enlighten me further." So they enlighten him further in transcendental knowledge. So now we're going through knowledge. First it was, again, these sequence, rituals, karmakanda, to achieve the fruits of one's desire. Now comes Gyanakanda, and then Narada begins speaking the principles of bhakti. Hearing the principles of bhakti, King Chittaketu was actually a very qualified person, just with this little problem that he was attached, but like madly attached. So now that attachment is gone, and he takes up a life of bhakti, and he's very powerful king. So he, in the course of practicing his bhakti, he, in his very lifetime, he ascends to the heavenly region. Vidyadhara Loka. It's in the heavenly region. And he becomes the ruler in one of the heavenly regions. And he continues to practice bhakti. And in the course of that practice, he attracts Lord Shiva. Not as a worshipper of Lord Shiva, but Lord Shiva appreciates his devotion to the personality of Godhead so much, they come more or less, not exactly, but like friends, like equals. He becomes very, very exalted. So one time, he was making a visit to his friend, Lord Shiva, and he was passing over Kailash in his Vimana, his airplane, and looking over the edge of the airplane, he sees Lord Shiva and Parvati seated on Lord Shiva's lap. So he calls out to Lord Shiva, "Hey, Lord Shiva, what's this? Parvati's on your lap." And what he was meaning to say was, "Who but a person like you can remain unagitated even in such a circumstance?" But Parvati didn't understand it that way. She understood that he was ridiculing or demeaning Lord Shiva. So when his plane, his Vimana, landed, Parvati let him have it. Said, "You're a big offender. You don't understand Lord Shiva at all. This mentality of offending Lord Shiva is demoniac. I curse you, you become a demon." Just like that, she exploded. "Don't mess with Parvati." And King Chittaketu didn't respond at all in any shocked manner, or he, with folded palms, he said to Parvati, "I didn't mean to speak as I spoke in a way that was diminishing the glory of your good husband. Rather, I was appreciating his glory. Who but Lord Shiva can do like this and remain undisturbed? But nonetheless, you have uttered these words, so I accept. So be it. I'm paraphrasing his words. And he circumambulated Parvati three times, returned to his Vimana, and ascended back to Vidyadhara Loka, and shortly thereafter, he took his birth as a demon, Vritrasura. So after King Chitraketu left, Parvati got scolded by Lord Shiva. He said, "You have spoken in a harsh way, saying that he's an offender to me, but actually you're an offender to him. He is my equal. And here's proof. When you spoke the way that you spoke, he remained completely undisturbed. Because this is the nature of a..." Now the phrase is Narayana Parayana. Remember? Vasudeva Parayana. So Keshit 6.1.15, Keshit Kevalaya Bhaktya Vasudeva Parayana. So here it is again. Narayana Parayana appears. Lord Shiva speaks. Narayana Parayana. Narayana Paraksarge Nakuchashchana Bibhyati Svarga Apavarga Narakeshu Apituliarta Darshanam. Svarga, we know what that is. That's heaven. Apavarga is liberation. This place is Pavarga, and Apavarga is beyond this place. And Narakeshu, we know what that is. That's the bad place. Hell. Naraka. So, such a person as Chitraketu, who is Narayana Parayana, looks equally upon heaven, liberation, or hell. Because he's Narayana Parayana. So supposing somebody said to you, I have a secret for you. Narada Muni told me, tomorrow you're going to be liberated. Really? Tomorrow I'm going to be liberated. But we become very happy. Or supposing, you know, I have some news for you. Narada told me tomorrow you're going to hell. Or somebody just said, you know, go to hell. We'll be offended, we'll be hurt. You know, the happiness goes away and becomes the opposite. Or you're going to heaven. But a Narayana Parayana personality is indifferent. Why? Because their consciousness is completely absorbed in Narayana. And because of that degree of fullness of devotion to Narayana, this or that or the other thing is inconsequential. That's the position of a very elevated soul. We're not such elevated souls, but the Bhagavatam is teaching us the principle. And so let me share with you the second half of that verse 6.1.15, and then I'm done. So the first half is, again, Kechit. There are some. Kevalaya Bhaktya, absolute devotion. Vasudeva Parayana. Then, Agham. Agham means sin. It even sounds like it. You know, somebody hits you in the solar plexus and you go, Ugh. Agham. Sin. And the reaction to sin. Agham Dundvanti Karchneya. It's the sin and the even the tendency to do renewed, same bad activity. It's eradicated by that bhakti. And that the last part is Niharam Iva Bhaskaram. Iva is a it introduces a metaphor. From school, you know what a metaphor is? Metaphor and simile? What is it? Very good. Very good. She's right? Okay. She's verifying. You got it right. So Iva, like something that we know, is something that we don't know. It's a metaphor. Niharam Iva Bhaskaram. Bhaskaram means sunlight. And Niharam means fog or mist. So those, any of you from North India, you know the January and February and December months, there's fog in the early morning. Yes? So, because during the daytime there's sunlight and the earth gets warm, and then at night the earth keeps its heat but the air gets cold, and so the moisture that's in the air hangs low as fog. And it stays until the first rays of the sunlight come, and it goes like that. Not slowly, but it's at once. Niharam eva bhaskaram. Just like the sun, morning sun, immediately dissipates fog and mist. So similarly, the agham, the tendency for sin, is eradicated at once. By even a glimmer of this Vasudeva Parayana and Kevala Bhakti. You know, like what we're doing. If we do it properly, the potency is there. So within devotional service, even we're neophyte, we're just beginning, and we really don't know what's what so well. We have an idea, but not a clear idea. Nonetheless, it's very powerful. Starting with the holy name, just like you were all chanting japa together. So this, the rest of what follows, next 2.5 chapters, the rest of chapter 1, 2, and 3, is describing the theology of the holy name. Because our practice is not karmakanda or gyanakanda, our process is bhakti. And bhakti begins, for us, by involving people in chanting the holy name. It begins. So it's just like the sun rise begins by little boop, the dawn. Before it's even, you can see the direct rays of sun, there's what's called dawn, or abhas in Sanskrit. It's a reflection of the sun, the rays of the sun without directly seeing the sun. When the sun comes on the horizon, you've watched the sunrise, maybe in city life it's a little difficult, but where it's not big buildings all over the place, you can see the sun coming on the horizon. It's this golden big globe. And then you have the direct rays of the sun when they hit your eye is different than before the sun rises. And then the globe gets smaller and smaller and brighter and brighter and brighter until it's the full rays of the sun. But even that beginning glimpse of the sun is sufficient to take away the fog. And similarly, the beginning of devotional service is sufficient to take away not only the reactions of sin, but the potency is there even to take away the tendency. Now we can hold on to the tendency, that's also possible. But the potency, if we wish to get rid of tendency, the potency is there. If we take shelter of the holy name and the other aspects of devotional service, it begin with hearing and chanting, Shravanam Kirtanam Vishnu Smaranam. If we begin that process with attention, very powerful. We don't need karmakanda and gyanakanda. We need very strong attention to go to the direct feature of the sun or Krishna, because he's the source of all things. And all of his spiritual potencies are within in each and every one of his names. Lord Chaitanya taught us that. Nija Sarva Shaktis. Nam Nam Akari Bahudad. Nija Sarva Shaktis. Krishna is very kind. He has innumerable names, and each and every one of those names is invested with all of his transcendental potencies. And that's a lot of potency. Inconceivable potency. How potent is the source of everything, and all of his potency is there. How potent is the sun? Powerful. And the sun is just a fragment of one of his material energies, and all of his spiritual and material energies are invested in each and every one of his names. So it's a very powerful process, and it awakens the tendency, the dormant consciousness of our relationship with the Supreme. Side by side with hearing these wonderful messages of Srimad Bhagavatam that give us clarity of the theology of the holy name, and moreover how to lead our lives in all features of life. In student life, just cited one verse where Bhagavatam is giving us an understanding of how to conduct our life in student life, certain principles to live by, and householder life, and you know, working life, and everything is there, how to lead our lives and how to make our hearts pure. From the same source as that which describes the structure of the universe, Vedic wisdom is, how would you characterize it? It's awesome. It's complete. And it's this descending back to this, what Prabhupada wanted the world to appreciate with the planetarium is descending knowledge doesn't require figuring it out. It's not by ascending process, it's descending process. And it's from the perfect person, just have to receive it properly, small thing, but receive it properly, and you have perfect knowledge of everything. How to lead your life, and what's what, and what our purpose is here, how to return to our original home. We got lost, and there's some unpleasant things about being in this material world, and it's suffering is really unnecessary. It's actually foreign to the soul. We belong in a position of eternality, knowledge, and bliss. That's what we want. It's natural to us. We're entitled to it. And there's a methodology to regain it. It's within the pages of Srimad Bhagavatam. We just have to open it and bring it in. And that which helps us to be inspired to do that is the chanting of the holy name. Very simple. Something that anyone can do, a child can do, and an old person can do, and people that doesn't know the language can do. Very effective. Means of cleansing the heart and awakening our dormant Krishna consciousness. So, that's a little appreciation of the message of Srimad Bhagavatam. A little bit of the structure of how Karmakanda, Gyanakanda, and Bhagavat Dharma or Upasana Kanda is laid out just in a few verses here in this first canto. And some encouragement for all of you to chant. And when the little video comes out about what this Vedic planetarium is called, Prabhupada gave it a name, Temple of Vedic Planetarium. Very specific. Not, you know, Shri Shri Radha Madan Mohan Mandir. Or Shri Shri Radha Madhava Mandir. Temple of Vedic Planetarium. Cool, huh? It was very visionary of what he wanted. And it took us a while, but just by the grace of God and some sincere endeavors of some very capable and talented persons. They now have a plan for this planetarium. Compliments of Ambarish Prabhu. You know, we're something like a third of the way there to complete. At least the superstructure is nearly completed. There was hope that we would be able to move the deities, Radha Madhava, in the year 2016, because that's the 50th anniversary of ISKCON being formed. It's not going to happen because they're not there yet. They don't think they're going to need lots and lots more funds. But we're committed. The leaders of our society are committed to somehow see that this happens. Prabhupada wanted it very much, and it's wonderful when it will be completed. Let's see. So when you hear some presentation spoken of at the temple on the TOVP, that's the acronym, Temple of Vedic Planetarium, now you know what it is. You can go find out about it and celebrate when the thing is open, and maybe between now and then you can do your little part to help make it happen somehow. Any discussion or questions? Yes? It's in Mayapur. Sridham Mayapur is in West Bengal, the birthplace of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Okay. Anyone else? Yes.
Maharaj, from the discussion, two things seems to be apparent, like the case of Chitraketu, he had material attachments, and because of that, he was not in a position to receive or appreciate the knowledge that would be given to him by those sages.
He wasn't just attached, he was madly attached.
And then when
he got unattached.
He got unattached. Then he was in a position, but it was a position of suffering.
Because yes.
So
doesn't have to be like that.
Yeah, it's an involuntary way of receiving that knowledge. Whereas it looks like the other process is, it could be a voluntary process.
Yeah, that's better.
And it could be as simple as taking up the process of chanting the
whole yeah.
things.
So take your pick. He was very qualified. Obviously, from hearing what he heard, we hear what he heard, and we're not doing the same thing that he did. He was very, very qualified. At the same time, there was this deep, mad attachment. And he was miserable. So that attachment was relieved in a very expert way by Angira Muni. So same thing could happen in our case, some, you know, fastidious attachment to something or some things that we won't let go of. If Krishna is very kind, he can help relieve us of that. But voluntary is better than by misery and suffering. Although that may happen too. Yeah.
The scriptures, particularly Srimad Bhagavatam, contain very nice principles and
yeah.
very useful knowledge.
Yes.
Sometimes it happens so that persons might be carrying some previous consumptions and they are not willing to consider that yet. Because
it's not unique to you. So, you carry on.
Given that situation, what could a person in that situation do?
I recommend those things that you do understand and they resonate, then you apply them in your life. And see what happens. And when you see, wow, then what happens? Following that, you apply something that resonates, you get some realization, some wow realization. So that says, well, let me go back to that source that I heard that thing from and let me hear something further. And it may not be that a particular, the same one that you didn't so much want to hear. Maybe you hear something else, and so you apply that something else. And just like that. Step by step. Incrementally. Things that really, with faith, this makes sense. I'm ready to move with it, bring it to your heart, and then move with it. And then gradually, other things will loosen, and the heart will soften, and other things will start to go in. Anyone else? Yeah.
Kichit kevalaya bhaktya, like the exclusive attachment to Krishna.
Uh-huh.
But so there is a fear, especially from the people from Indian background, that so if we are exclusively attached to Krishna, are we disrespecting the other personalities?
Okay.
But
so how to address the fear?
Yes.
Well, it can be with knowledge or it can be intuitively. With knowledge, the position can be the explanation that Prabhupada gives is when you water the root of a tree, it's from the Bhagavatam actually, when you water the root of a tree, what happens with the water? The trunk of the tree gets water, the branches get water, the twigs and leaves get water, the flowers of the tree get water, everything gets water. Just by putting water on the root of the tree. So you're not neglecting any part of the tree. Just put water on the root of the tree. Or another iva, another metaphor, is by giving food to the stomach, you're not depriving any other part of the body of the benefit of the nourishment from the food by giving it to the stomach. You're not neglecting the hand or neglecting the knee or the foot or the head or any other part of the body. Just put the food in the stomach and the food, the nourishment goes to the whole of the body. Similarly, by finding the root of all existence, place your devotion and your worship and your attention and your everything there, and the benefit is distributed everywhere. Put the food in the stomach, nourishment goes to all the parts of the body, simultaneously and naturally. That's the natural process. Similarly, worshipping the personality of Godhead, the benefit to be derived to one and to the devatas, the various personalities governing the universe that have come from the source of the universe, they themselves worship the Supreme. By worshipping the Supreme, it's not negligence or disrespect to the demigods. As a for example, supposing somebody in their childhood worshipped Ram, and then they come to the stage of thinking, well, maybe I can worship Hanuman. And then I think, oh, I've met some devotees and they're worshipping Ram, but I don't want to offend Hanuman. So, to them I say, go ask Hanuman. Hanuman, is it okay if I worship Ram? What's he going to say? Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram, worship Ram. Or, in my upbringing, it's not just, people from India, it's, my upbringing, I was brought up in a Christian family. So, the same dilemma. Different context, same dilemma. Am I being disrespectful to Christ? All that I've received in value and teachings and compassion and all the nice things of Christ's teachings, am I forsaking Christ by worshiping Krishna? And it was easy. I mean, it was a dilemma for a while. It was a sincere existential dilemma. But everything that Christ taught is something that I'm doing better than before. And will Christ be pleased or displeased? He'll be very pleased. Like Hanuman, be very pleased. You worship Ram. So it's not disrespectful. It's included. It's exactly as Krishna says in his concluding instruction to Bhagavad Gita. Sarvadharmam parityaja mamekam sharanam braja mamekam sharanam aham tvam sarva papebhyo. All sinful reactions will be eradicated. Moksha yishami masuchaha. Masuchaha, if you have any doubt, dismiss that doubt. Masuchaha. It's not disrespectful, it's not ignoring, it may be different than what you did when you were younger. It's just the mature stage of that which you were younger. I feel very grateful to the tradition in which I grew up in and my parents for enriching me with all the values that they taught me, and now I'm doing that better than I was doing it before. And I'm not disrespecting them or the tradition in which I grew up. I'm maturing in both. Now, initially, my parents didn't quite see it that way. But eventually, they came to appreciate exactly as I described. Not exactly, but close. They could understand what I'm doing is, because that's demigods, and the other is, you know, parents' expectation that you, why don't you do like we did?
Yes.
But they appreciated our son is really dedicated to something that is genuine and ancient, because they did their homework. It's an ancient tradition. It's not some new creation. Very, very ancient tradition. And he's doing good work for lots and lots of people, and he's very happy, and so we're proud of him. That's not how it started, but that's where it ended up. Okay, so anything else? Okay, well, thank you all for being patient. I hope there's some value in some of the things you heard this evening.
Have some Srimad Bhagavatam copies, Maharaj.
You have copies or sets?
Sets.
Okay. Something that our ISKCON's founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada wanted very much was that I'll just share this little anecdotal thing. Once he was visiting at the University of California in Berkeley, 1969 or 1970, long ago. And there was an Indian graduate student at UC Berkeley who heard Prabhupada speak, and at the end he raised his hand and stood up to challenge Prabhupada. He said, "Why have you come to this country as a beggar?" And Prabhupada said, "I have not come as a beggar, I've come as a giver. You have come as a beggar. You want technology, and you find you can get that technology in the West, and why do you want that technology? So you can get some money. You come as a beggar for the technology of the West. I've come as a giver. I have this wisdom, and I'm offering it liberally to everyone. And through this wisdom, the sufferings of all mankind can be mitigated. And if mankind can live properly, the sufferings of all other species of life can be diminished by the good direction of the humankind. I've come as a giver." So he wished very much, out of compassion, traveled all over the world for the purpose of people he didn't even know. I was one of them, who he didn't even know, just to come and give knowledge of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam to us. Why? Not to sell a product, make a profit. Not like that. Out of compassion. Because this knowledge can transform lives. So that unnecessary, untold volumes of suffering that anyone that's not living a life in devotion may have to encounter unnecessarily can be relieved, and not only relieved of suffering, but experience the natural joy and happiness of the soul's original and natural position. And how to do that is all within these literatures. So we have our leaders in the U.S. and Canada, we meet once a year in January and make a plan for the year and of how we want to, you know, conduct our activities in our centers in U.S. and Canada. So one of the things that we do is we make a plan of how to give this wisdom to others, and we make some kind of commitment, like a pledge or, you know, a goal. And part of our goal this year was 1,500 sets of Srimad Bhagavatam would be distributed in the U.S. and Canada, and 500 sets of Chaitanya Charitamrita, the life of Lord Chaitanya, would be distributed in the U.S. and Canada. And we're a third of the way there already in the first quarter. Because there's a lot of enthusiasm, and the reason the enthusiasm is not just because we made a goal, but because with appreciation of what's in these literatures, we wish to not just keep it on our shelf and, you know, every day study the message, but give that same opportunity to others. So the the publishing headquarters is in Los Angeles, the BBT, Bhaktivedanta Book Trust. They have 1,800 sets, because I'm convinced we're going to go way over and we're going to need more sets. So the Potomac Temple made an advance purchase of some sets, expecting that they're going to go out quickly. So if you don't have a set of Srimad Bhagavatam in your home, please consider. I have no idea what the temple is requesting. You can ask Mahamantra. But the something that Prabhupada said is his desire was that every gentleman have Srimad Bhagavatam and Chaitanya Charitamrita in their home. In the Garuda Purana, it says one who keeps it on your shelf in your home. Your home, it's like keeping a deity, because it's the form, literary form, as a deity is another form. This is a literary form of the Supreme Lord. So just, even if you don't take it off your shelf, just have it on your shelf and respect it. It'll bring good fortune into your home. What to speak of if on a regular basis you open the book and read a few verses and meditate on the message and slowly take that message into your heart. It personal experiences, it changes, doesn't necessarily change the world, but it changes how you experience the world. It's transforming of consciousness. And when consciousness is transformed, then it also has an impact on the world. And the more jivas, more living entities are carrying bhakti in their heart in this way, it's the best cure, revolutionary, a spiritual revolution for the world. A quiet, not with guns and the other kind, a spiritual revolution. In fact, there's a verse that says that directly in the Bhagavatam. Tadvag visarga janata agha viplava. There's the word agha again. Sin. Agha viplava. This message of Srimad Bhagavatam is meant to create a spiritual revolution in the impious lives of the people of this age of Kali. Because it transforms hearts. It cleanses the heart and it gives direction to the heart, to the soul, towards the service of the Supreme. So if you don't have, if you do have Srimad Bhagavatam in your home, please read it regularly. And if you don't have, acquire it, even if it just sits for a while till you get ready to read it regularly. It's wonderful. It'll be, you'll be inspired in course of time to read it. And as you do, it's life changing. So you can see Maha Mantra if you have interest. Thank you all very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.